Welcome to the third episode. Did I count third? Boy, you know, it's a sign of my mental decline that I can't even count up to the number three. Third episode of And the Winner Should Have Been. I am Bob, one of two hosts, here with my friend Mark.
Hey, folks.
There you go. You can say hello. And we're going to talk about, as promised last time, Dances with Wolves and Goodfellas, mostly. Though I think I'm going to try and sneak some more movies in here because, spoiler alert, I'm not the biggest fan of either one of those films. So
I'm glad you had time to watch some others. I did not. So you'll be able to add some extra flavor onto this one.
This may be the last episode where I get to do that, though. I don't know, because I did get a job. I actually start tomorrow from when we're recording. So now that I will no longer be an idle, you know, wastrel of a man, my days full of film and goofing off, I may not get to as many films now.
If you thought this podcast was low production already, just get wait until we have no time on our hands to produce it anymore.
Exactly. Yeah. So, but anyways, that's kind of, for me, the big news is that,
pre-work first day, like butterflies or anything, or what's going on in your head?
I do. It was a little weird. I started off feeling just relieved, immensely relieved.
Of course. I've been
out of work for 2 months, which, you know, granted, could have been worse for a lot of reasons, but I wanted to get a job. So I got the job, felt relieved. Mm-hmm. And then after a day or two, it started being, that nervousness of the new experience.
Yeah.
It's been a long time since I was starting a new job in a truly new experience. Because I worked for that, the company we worked for together for 20 years, a little more than 20 years. And I moved around internally, but that's not the same thing at all, really. So
interviewing must have been weird. I think we've talked about that before, but also just like your expectations on what a different corporate culture is like are completely, it's hard to know if you have expectations that are reasonable, right? It's weird.
Yeah. Yeah, it's going to be very unusual. The senior VP is the, my grand boss right now. So it's like, that's not what I'm used to. So,
yeah, that's cool, man. That's awesome.
Yeah. How have you been?
I've been good. There's not a ton of major updates in my space. One of them I'm almost afraid to say because I know your opinion on this topic, but my wife and I have actually been, 2.5 weeks we've been eating vegan. We have a plant-based diet for the last 2.5 weeks. And I'll preface this with saying, this wasn't us. It's not a philosophical choice to protect animals or the planet. It's actually because my extended family, my immediate family, they're all vegan because my brother is kind of the chef and he lives with my parents and he kind of forced it on them to go plant-based when he wanted to do the diet.
Oh, man.
So when we did that trip to Crescent City, California, as I mentioned in our last podcast, we ate vegan that whole time. So we just figured, hey, why don't we just give it a go when we get home and see how it feels, what it's like. And it has not been too bad. I've lost a couple of pounds and I'm feeling good, but we'll see what the future holds in terms of how long I can do this.
Yeah, I have very much stronger opinions about people that do this for moralistic kinds of reasons.
Right? Yeah.
The idea that like I need to save the animals and stuff, which I won't get into here because this isn't the podcast for that. But for people that do it just for other reasons, right? Like just because for whatever, I always think of that bit in Pulp Fiction where Samuel L. Jackson and John Travolta are in the diner and they're talking about food because they're sitting there eating breakfast. It's like a Denny's or something they're in, but it's not branded that way, but you can tell. And Samuel L. Jackson is talking about why he won't eat pigs, right? Pigs are a filthy animal. And John Travolta's response really sums up my response to people that are like, I'm going to go vegan. It's like, yeah, but bacon is good. Pork chops are good. It's like, how could you? It's good. All right, fair enough.
And that's where
do without it. But
that's where I land too, is like, My brother's on the opposite end of the spectrum. He's like, he will argue with you that plant-based food tastes just as good as non-plant-based food, which, you know, it's fun to fool yourself, isn't it? But I'm of the opinion that, like, there's no point in arguing that. I love, you know, meat, love animal products. I just think, if anything, I'll probably ultimately just weave more plant-based food into my diet versus be kind of religious about it. So...
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, this isn't really that important of a topic in a lot of ways. the real reaction I have, again, like I said, is people get moralistic about it. Mm-hmm. You know, the joke about how do you know when someone is a vegan atheist CrossFitter? It's like, you don't have to be able to tell. They'll tell you.
They'll tell you.
Yeah. So
usually it's visible anyways, but.
Right. But yeah, you know, if you want to do that, that's great. I guess that just means more bacon for me. So,
yeah, fair enough.
Cool. Well, in keeping with the pattern, which we are slowly developing, I think that the first thing to do would be to briefly talk about the two films for anybody that is not familiar with them, kind of what they are. And then we'll start with the winner and then move from there. Two films that did not win, but that maybe they should have.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see. So. Would you rather do Goodfellas or talk about Dances with Wolves here?
I'll talk about Dances.
All right, go for it.
Dances with Wolves, it's kind of, so it's about Civil War Army lieutenant who gets injured but sort of reacts with bravery and sort of moral fiber to earn himself some serious commendations by his senior officers at a significant battle or a turning point during the war. I forget what the historical battle the film is based off of. I'm not sure if you know.
I'm not even sure it was a real big one. It may have even been fictional. I didn't look it up.
Yeah, we can maybe pull up a tab on that here as we get going. But earns himself commendations even while being wounded kind of during that battle, to the extent that they offer him the opportunity to basically pick his next post for the remainder duration of the war. And so he decides that, kind of having already seen hard action, he wants to go out and see the American frontier, or what's left of it, perhaps for the last time, and be kind of stationed on his own or with just a few individuals at a remote outpost on the frontier. So I think the film is based in the Dakotas, South Dakota, and also was filmed on site. But he ends up out there, and to his surprise, there is no one there. The outpost is deserted. There are, you know, a number of Native American tribes in close proximity to the outpost, one of which, the Sioux, he begins befriending, and ultimately kind of that relationship changes his entire perspective and the rest of his life in military service.
Yeah, yeah, it's an interesting film. It's, I think, clearly a Western, if you had to pick a genre for it. And as a Best Picture winner, and we can get into more of this, it is one of the very, very few Westerns to win Best Picture.
I saw that, or
even be nominated. Yeah. So Goodfellas, which I think is probably the film that a lot of people would point to from the same year as being perhaps a better contender for Best Picture, one that should have won. Both because of staying power and then maybe even topically, I think Westerns are just not popular now as they once were. And I think was true then, and it's still unquestionably true today. Goodfellas is really, it says it's based on a true story. I have to admit, I'm not a fan of this movie. I didn't bother to check that. It's about the rise of a particular individual through the ranks of a mafia organization and then his subsequent downfall and essentially becoming what they would consider a traitor, a rat, turning in the evidence. What's the term for that? State's evidence or something like that, right? Against his former colleagues in order to avoid prison and possible death at the hands of people that would rather see him dead than having the opportunity to talk if you wanted to. So Ray Liotta as the main character, but a lot of big names and names that would become bigger names subsequently in that movie.
Yeah. What did you, I mean, do we want to dive into one of these? I already have like follow-up questions for you on your opinions on these. But
well, I think the Dances with Wolves, we can talk about that one first of all.
Okay.
It's I do like it better, I think, of the two, but I can't say that I'm really very fond of it either.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen it described as Dances with Sunsets, kind of calling out Kevin Costner for his delight in putting people on a hilltop and silhouetting them against the sunset, or having a lot of stuff like that happen. It is beautifully shot. Going on location in South Dakota was amazing. But I think the film is overly long at 3 hours.
It's very long.
And that's even reduced from his original cut, obviously. Mm-hmm. Directors tend to come in beyond that, whatever the final cut ends up being. And there are things about it that are a little incoherent, things that are definitely problematic in today's environment, though I don't know that I would really be upset about them.
I wanted to talk about that at some point.
Sure, sure. Yeah. I mean, we can dive right into that. I think what's interesting is I would have characterized the opening differently, though. Mm. That I don't think that he was necessarily being brave. I think he was being suicidal.
Yeah, I may have came at that from kind of the ultimate perception of what he had done.
Oh,
yeah. And
that's certainly the case, that what he did was perceived as a brave act, mm-hmm. and he was therefore rewarded when he survived what was perceived to be a brave act. But I think that, it starts with the very graphic depiction of what it's like to be in a Civil War field hospital, amputated limbs, and he decides, you know, forget this noise, I'm going to go back out on the battlefield and get somebody to shoot me. Yeah. And as a consequence, when he isn't shot, he does survive. He keeps his leg. You know, things go well for him in a sense.
I think that's one of the only times in scenes like that in films where I've kind of like resonated with his choice to try and die, because that field hospital was absolutely horrific. Like what he would have put himself through. I think the stats from back then show that he had a high likelihood of probably dying from getting his leg cut off to prevent gangrene or whatever the infections would be. Mm-hmm. So his decision, you know, kind of at that point with how wounded he was to ride out and basically get shot to death, didn't seem that unrealistic to me, which is weird.
No, definitely not. And because they did not understand the causes of infection, for someone who did not have an infection, mm-hmm. it was probably also at that point a greater risk to have an amputation.
Right.
Because they're going to have to cut through bone and a bunch of other things. And it would increase the opportunity for infection to occur.
Right.
I think more people actually died of things like that than actually died from those actual kinds of wounds.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember which war it was where it finally flip-flopped. Might have been World War II.
Advances in medicine, right? Would have been like penicillin and stuff like that.
Right, where it was direct enemy action began to mm-hmm. cause more deaths than subsequent infections from wounding and illness.
Right.
So, yeah. Clearly, the rational choice, I think, was to leave the hospital, even if he didn't understand why that was. Yeah.
Did you enjoy that scene overall? I kind of like it.
I did. I was a little off-put by his false beard at first.
That and his mustache were pretty bad.
Yeah. Though, is this an artifact of me being able to watch it, you know, in high def on a very large screen, whereas, you know, seeing it on film in a theater once upon a time or on home video would not have been,
mm-hmm.
you know, maybe. I'm reluctant to fault people too much for that. I'm not, and this goes back to kind of how I think about film. I'm not really opposed to poor effects.
Mm-hmm.
I think you should make them as nice as you can make them, but if the story you're telling is strong, if your dialogue is well written, if your actors are giving the, you know, good performance, they're really trying to sell the material, I don't care that if you bump into the scenery it wobbles a little bit.
Yeah.
Like for me, that is not off-putting. So, mm-hmm. you know, it was interesting to notice, but that's fine. You know, he needed a beard that he didn't have time or the ability to grow. Fine. Slap a false beard on there. That's fine.
Yeah. I think they were trying to make it very Civil War like with an interesting drip down, not a handlebar mustache, but like downward handled, kind of bedraggled mustache. It was, yeah. It was an interesting look. In terms of like the early scenes in the movie, one I'm wondering what your opinion on is, but is always kind of stuck with me, is where he talks to that commanding officer as he approaches the frontier, in that kind of official office building or whatever. And that guy just has no idea who he is, you know, what kind of person he is, or really what he's being sent to do, but he is just on his way out the door for suicide himself.
It didn't make any sense to me.
Yeah, that's a very weird scene.
I didn't understand it. I didn't know what they were trying to say or were trying to do. It didn't seem particularly authentic in any way. I was just very confused.
I think that was a scene that really for me was like, yeah, Costner hasn't directed that many films. I think he's only directed like three at this point in his career. Obviously, this is one of them that he also acts in, but he was trying to put that scene in there, I think, to create some additional layering around like why people felt him going to the frontier was pretty futile and a poor decision. But it just ended up being way over the top dramatic with that army officer.
Yeah, it was very weird. I mean, I like that actor too. Maury Chaykin is the actor there, and I've seen him in some other stuff. I think he's great, but it didn't make sense. Yeah, I was wondering if this was still some residual effects of attitudes about Vietnam creeping in towards institutional military and the people that would inhabit that, but. I don't know.
It's almost like a reverse Robert Duvall from the last film we talked about with Apocalypse Now. Someone who's not confident or like content with their position, they're overly impacted by it.
Yeah, or just the portrayal of the military as being inhabited, you know, professional soldiers as being I don't want to say incompetent, but just not right in the head.
That lunatics,
to have that kind of job, you would, well, of course he's crazy, you know, what else would you be? Because there really was, I think, a negative backlash in a lot of popular culture after Vietnam. You have the good war with World War II and all a lot of very positive media produced regarding that, at least as regards our involvement and the people who were in it. And then it kind of bends back the other way with, you know, change in the country's political attitudes in the 60s and the 70s.
Right.
But I don't know. I think that was, if that's what it was a passing thing because that's really not what the movie is about. So
it's certainly a passing moment in how long that film is. I just wondered if he really needed to have it as a sequence in something that was going to become 3+ hours.
Well, I think the narrative purpose that it serves and the reason it has to be left in is to explain why nobody knows that he's there.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Because without that, nobody's going to know. People will know where he's at, and it's possible that he would have, you know, someone else would have come to check on him sooner or something.
So
it establishes his isolation.
Yeah, after that wagon ride out to the outpost, we reach like the core part of the film, which probably runs, I don't know, over an hour and a half long with zero contact with the military. And it's all just him in isolation with contact with the Native American Sioux tribe that's nearby.
Right.
So each part of the movie is kind of bookended with his military kind of connections and exposure. But the film in the middle, which probably I may have understated, maybe it's closer to 2 hours in length, that segment.
I think it probably is. I mean, the beginning and the end are fairly short. It's probably close to 2 hours. Yeah. Just him interacting with, dealing with, befriending various things you know, with the Sioux. I was thinking about this, and I was thinking about Costner in this role. I think he does all right. It has a strangely modern feel to it. That though it's set when it is, and they went to great lengths, I think, for some kinds of authenticity. Not that I'm in any way a scholar on, you know, Native American culture or anything like that, but they certainly made efforts in that direction, I think. But his attitudes towards them and towards just what he says about wanting to see the frontier before it disappears seems anachronistic to me. Did people really think like that in 1860, whatever? I don't know that they did.
That was actually one of my critiques at a broader level about, like, you know, he says he wants to go to the frontier, but at that point in the film, have they really convinced us of, like, who Kevin Costner is as a character? Like, why is he so special in comparison to his sort of barbaric American comrades? He seems to be sort of like, you know, very forward-looking and kind of more in touch with his softer side when it comes to, like, the arts and appreciating the beauty of nature, versus everyone around him is kind of just either a lunatic or barbaric. So I don't know why he's so special at that point in the film. They haven't really convinced me.
Yeah, I guess that's part of what they're trying to demonstrate over the course of his getting there, right? Mm-hmm. That he must be that kind of person, because who else would choose
would do that?
To go there, and through the narrative voice provided by his, you know, journaling, which, again, both these movies with the narrative, you know, the narrator talking to you.
It's good. Yeah, that's true.
Was this a thing? I don't remember it being a thing, but.
Well, it's also a way to, like, facilitate plot development if you're not sure how to weave in transitional scenes or how much time you have.
Yeah, he still goes 3 hours, though. I mean, well,
I think Goodfellas had more of a case to do that than Costner did in Dances with Wolves.
Yeah, but that one's still 2.5.
Bro, no, it's long. I just mean the way that those scenes are electrically kind of cut in and out with what the gang members are doing, I think makes more sense for quick narration than Costner. Just whatever, his 30-minute opening has tons of narration. Yeah.
Yes, that's okay. So that's true.
Yeah.
But it really feels like a crutch, particularly in Dances with Wolves, that he's having to tell us so much rather than find ways to show
us. And show us. Oh yeah. It's a critique for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. He as that figure, though, I think we are often more told that, as you say, and we just are supposed to accept that that's who this is. It is, to a degree, the answer to the critique of any story about, you know, knowing that people are going to survive to the end, right? Will Kevin Costner live through this film? Well, he's going to at least make it to the last 5 minutes.
Of course, yeah.
Even if he dies at the end of the film, we know that, you know, at the midway point, whatever peril he's in, he's not actually in any peril. But the problem is, of course, is that if he was going to actually die, then we wouldn't have this story. Right? So I think this is part of the same thing, that, of course, he has to be this, you know, spiritual, touchy-feely, woo-woo kind of guy to a degree, because otherwise he would have turned around when he first got there. And gone back with the wagon.
Right.
You know, or he would have actually gotten into a conflict with the Sioux and fought them.
Right.
Instead of making friends. I can kind of forgive it a little bit. I don't know.
Yeah.
But they don't do a great job of portraying it so much as explaining it. I agree with you there.
They definitely don't. So you mentioned this earlier. I was going to ask you, like, do you think this movie, this film, has aged well in terms of how tastefully it approached Native American relations? I think this could be something we could talk about for a while, or we could avoid drama and only talk about it for a little bit. But there's definitely some at least risks or implications here of a very hot term these days, cultural appropriation. There's that. There's also, I thought it was an interesting choice, maybe a good one, maybe a bad one. I wanted to know your thoughts on him ultimately marrying the only, like, white person in the tribe. Like, did they have to have a white girl in the tribe for him to marry? Was that a choice to be, you know, was that a political kind of, like, choice to do something that wouldn't come across poorly? Or I don't know.
I think the answer to that, well, so to work backwards.
There's multiple points. Yeah. Yeah.
I think that part of the reason they did that was just because they didn't think about it as much. The world, as someone who was, I'm not going to get into how old you are or anything like that, but I was definitely older than you when this movie came out.
Yeah.
As I am today still, I guess that's always going to be the case. But the world then, in some ways, was just a lot more unreflecting on these kinds of things. Mm-hmm. People didn't think about it as much. Mm-hmm. The Washington football team at the time, called the Redskins, was a thing that people did complain about, and there were disputes and there was some controversy over that. But at the same time, it just wasn't as big of a deal. Mm-hmm. I feel like I'm explaining this poorly, but I don't know that they thought about the fact that they were pairing up the two white characters to have the romantic interest together so much as they needed someone, again, narratively, to be able to communicate with him. Mm-hmm. And the easiest way to explain that was to use an actual, you know, kind of event that occurred where someone would be kidnapped essentially as a child during an Indian raid and then raised as, you know, in that Native American, you know, culture or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And as a consequence, when you're trying to come up with a reason for him to have a romantic interest, there's a lot of things narratively and culturally or whatever that are natural and normal that make that kind of make sense.
Mm-hmm. That was my thought too, is that they wanted to have a love interest. They obviously needed to get over this hurdle of communication, and it probably just kind of made sense to them in that moment to combine both of those things. I'm wondering, and neither of us can really answer this. This is sort of just a question I throw out to the wind, but like, I'm wondering if like Native American audiences to this movie today think that that was the right decision instead of having him marry a Native American and kind of cross cultural boundaries, or if they think that it's sort of a trope of like, the white guy marries the white girl. You know what I mean? I wonder how that's sort of been received by audiences today.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know, obviously, either what the predominant opinion would be, but I think that there's always been and will always be, in some measure, people that disagree on that.
Yeah.
There are studies that they've done, and I don't have any of these to hand because I didn't think we would go down this rabbit hole this far, but where if you look at like attitudes towards people getting married and then compare like the 1970s to today, in the 1970s, people of all races were far more likely to be very much against their son or daughter marrying someone of a different race than of a different political party. And it is essentially flip-flop now that most people today would have no problem whatsoever with their son or daughter marrying someone of a different race, but would be really upset if they belonged to a different political party.
Never thought about it that way. That's very interesting.
And I think that you're always going to have those kinds of attitudes depending on who you are and how you think about this, right? Mm-hmm. That if you're taking the kind of more progressive woke stance about cultural appropriation being bad and, you know, that these sorts of things need to be, you know, people kept separate and distinct in some ways, you're going to have one opinion. And if you're more the, you know, MLK content of their character rather than the color of their skin kind of attitude, then you're going to think it's not that big a deal, or it wouldn't have been a big deal if he'd married someone who was, you know, part of the tribe. Yeah.
Yeah.
They're kind of caught in a rock at a hard place, you know.
Totally.
One group of people, sized to be variable dependent on the year you're checking, is going to be upset no matter which choice they make and say you should have done it the other way.
I think one thing that kind of assuages my concerns with that, with this film, is that I think their intentions were good with this content. I think Kevin Costner, and obviously I'm making assumptions here, but based on kind of my impression, what I've read, what I saw in the film, I think their goal was to do something that was considered woke for the time and paint obviously Native American culture, history, and that oppression in the most like positive and sort of accurate light that they could. I think that was really Costner's intent with this film. And if you read some of like his interviews afterwards, he's trying to be super tasteful with this. Whether or not that's aged well, I think their intent is good with the film.
Yeah.
They were not trying to make any mockery here of anything.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
No, no. And that's true. That's certainly clear in terms of what his intentions were. I always think of woke as being a very pejorative term. So it's interesting to think of that as positive. But yeah, and certainly at the time, in that moment, it was viewed that way.
Yeah.
I think I'd have to go look it up again. I'm pretty sure he was made an honorary member of some Sioux tribe as a consequence of the film.
Oh, interesting.
And the way it portrayed, you know, these kinds of things.
Well, that's great that in that time period, it was very well received.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that unquestionably, even if you think it was ham-handed or misguided or doesn't age well, that in the moment it was understood to be a positive thing, and probably more importantly, to come from a place of genuine concern for doing what was right and being honest and fair about things.
Right.
I mean, it didn't pull any punches about the way that the, you know, Native American tribes and the white settlers could interact at times. That there would be conflict and brutality, and that both sides could do things that were terrible. But it also was willing to say, you know, this is, I think, more a common feature of humanity.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. That people can be awful sometimes, but that we also have it within ourselves to strive to do the things that are right and honorable and just.
Right. There's sort of representatives from both sides of that equation, whether it's the Native American tribes or it's the Civil War soldiers, right? The Union soldiers. Yeah.
And I think he even does that at the end, too, with the soldiers at the very, very end that essentially take him prisoner when he returns to the fort.
Right.
We've clearly been spoiling this and I didn't say anything about it, but yeah. The, I don't know if it's a lieutenant. I wasn't able to catch their ranks as they're going by. He's not the one in charge, but he's definitely an officer. He's the one that is escorting them back when they're going to take him back to the larger fort. He is clearly uncomfortable with the way they are treating him.
Right.
As being in opposition to them, right? And I think he feels or thinks that there would not have been this conflict had they not assumed that there would be a conflict.
He's cognizant of the problematic nature of what they're doing to him. Yeah. And he, but he's also maybe, unlike Costner, more of a cog in the machine to the extent that he does not feel he can act and stop it at that moment.
No, and that's true, but I would say that Costner would probably be that same character at the beginning of the film.
Maybe so, yeah.
Right? That with the major standing right there, with the sergeant, with the other soldiers standing around, will you feel constrained to behave in a particular way from that social pressure? And because you are still much more ignorant about who it is that you're dealing with and what the possibilities are.
There's no doubt that Costner is beholden to like the law and sense a sense of duty with all the narrated scripts of him writing in his journal. I fervently wait for reprieve with my fellow soldiers. You know, I'm doing these things to my post to prepare. He's a very dutiful character. So maybe you're right. He may have kind of fallen into a what have we done, a cog-like behavior at that moment as well.
Well, and I would even, I really rebel against this idea of him being mindless, right? As a mere cog in the machine, but that he would be very loyal to doing what he thinks is right.
Yeah.
And without a compelling knowledge of who the Sioux are and what it is that is motivating them or being able to communicate with them, right? That he would feel that duty to his oath and his uniform very strongly as being a pull on what was right and correct for him to do.
Yeah.
And I think you see that in the lieutenant, that he thinks that the major is being unwise, but that it is not his role to force him to do otherwise, that, you know, he has to argue for it as best he can, moderate it to the degree he is able, but that he is compelled legally and morally and, you know, by interest in justice to not openly oppose him.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of an interesting dilemma. And there's shades of that too. You know, there's the corporal, is a low ranking soldier who steals the diary, you know, can't read it.
Easy to hate.
Yeah. But then I think the sergeant is another step on that spectrum up, right? Mm-hmm. That, you know, he is disposed to be hostile, but has a degree of professionalism in his conduct that he's not going to just beat up Kevin Costner's character, right? Because he's angry at him. He understands there are rules and I have to follow those rules and I have certain orders and obligations.
Right.
You know, the major is another step along that spectrum that he's perfectly willing to be reasonable. He's not in any way inclined to be angry or upset or mean or cruel, but he's more than willing to do that if people don't cooperate with him. Mm-hmm. And then the lieutenant, you know, say, or the captain, or whatever he is another step further, that he is inclined to be charitable, but feels bound to, you know, certain sorts of things. So you really get kind of a full picture of the different kinds of responses that people have based on their openness or their willingness to understand or experience these things.
A full spectrum of kind of an inside look into that person's position. Yeah.
Yeah. I need to go back and watch The Last Samurai and see if the Tom Cruise's character is named Dunbar.
I don't think this is
basically The Last Samurai, but just not in Japan.
So I'll throw it out there. I love The Last Samurai. I don't know if that is a movie that's tastefully done or appropriate, but boy, do I enjoy that film. It's like the only Tom Cruise film I will watch over and over again.
Oh, really? Oh, well.
Yeah.
Oh, well, we need to have a conversation about that one of these days. But that one I do enjoy a lot more, but it still has, there's the white savior complex a little bit, right? Our main character comes in, does some things that they can't do, teaches them some wisdom they don't have.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can argue about the nature of that a little bit, but it's the army officer from the same point in time who's become disillusioned with his comrades, who, you know, has an opportunity to go out to the frontiers of somewhere, encounters the natives there, likes their way of life, decides to become one of the, like,
you know what? It is very
had to walk so Tom Cruise could run.
It's very similar, and the only difference is sort of the character struggle of Tom Cruise, obviously being a drunk, having war demons of his own. That's the main difference. So it's almost like Martin Sheen from Apocalypse Now merged with Kevin Costner to become Tom Cruise in that type of role. You get what I mean? Personal demons, alcoholism, getting immersed in that new setting. Yeah.
Yeah. And there are other things as well. Mm-hmm. It just, the resonance between it is so pleasing to me, so amusing to me that I enjoy it. But Cruise as well is far more, he is less of a messiah when mm-hmm. he arrives. That is to say, he is incompetent.
He's a pariah, yeah.
He is, you know, in a position where he has to learn. He has to grow in a great deal more, I think, than Costner, who shows up, you know, with that ready-made spirituality and, you know, getting the cool name, dances mm-hmm. with wolves because he's making friends with the wolf. And, you know, like, he's just showing up already as, like, almost a shamanistic character.
So what are your, like, major critiques of the film? We should probably, like, leave space for Goodfellas and some others.
That's true. Going on here a little while.
What other things stood out to you is... Well, we can do things you really like, things you didn't like, but ultimately kind of this was the movie that won 7 awards, mm-hmm. Won Best Picture. So how does it live in its legacy for you? What are the problems and bright spots?
It's too long.
Mm-hmm.
It takes too much time. There's too much of the narration, too much of the telling and not the showing.
Yeah.
It goes a little bit overboard again, I think, with the white messiah coming in to save people. There are little details about it that don't make a lot of sense to me,
mm-hmm.
Which is why I think that it's probably good that it didn't win for things like costume and set decoration and things like that. What's her name? Mary McDonald's hair. Like, what is the deal with that?
That was really annoying. Like, that doesn't seem realistic in any way, shape, or form.
No. Everybody else had hairbrushes in that tribe. Why not her?
Well, just like, why would it be like that at all anyways? It's like it's purposefully brushed into something that's completely insane.
It seemed weird. I don't know. Maybe it's because she's in mourning. I don't know. I don't whatever. Yeah. And then I think it was a little bit too... I don't know. A little bit too pat, too little, too neat at the end.
The ending is my biggest problem.
Yeah. On the whole, it's fairly unobjectionable. And if it had been an hour and a half, I would have thought more highly of it than I did.
Mm-hmm.
But it just feels like it stretches out interminably. It's beautiful, but I start to really feel the weight of that, you know, critique that it's Dances with Sunsets. Supposedly, I think in Roger Ebert's original review, he talks about there's one scene where two characters are looking at each other and they're both have the sun setting behind them.
Which doesn't make any sense. Yeah.
Right. And again, that's fine, but he goes too far with a lot of these things. Nothing is terribly heinous. There's just a lot of little things I don't like about it.
For me, it's beautiful. It's a good period piece. It is too long. But the ending, I think, is extremely compressed. And basically, the conflict of the entire film is isolated to those last 20-something minutes, maybe. Which I think they could have made it so much less white savior if they had just woven the conflict earlier into the film. And spent less time on his like immersion and sort of like induction into the Sioux culture.
So you don't think that his contacts with them and his learning, mm-hmm. developing a friendship, etc., is a sufficient conflict to drive the core of the film?
Not really, because there isn't really much conflict there. If anything, they are so friendly to him, it's almost strange how they would not attack him when approaching their village completely unexpectedly. You know, there's lots of moments where I'm like, this must just be a friendly tribe with how they're treating him, because their entire exposure to, you know, white civilization, Western civilization up until that point has been nothing but violence and stuff they want to avoid. So I don't think that really, you know, struggling to communicate or, you know, be fully incorporated into the tribe is enough conflict for me. I think the story is mostly about how the frontier is dying. And that would have been more significant for me if it was more about that earlier in the film.
All right. Fair enough.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
But it's 3 hours long. I just think with 3 hours, they could have had more of that. I don't know. Yeah.
That's fair. That's fair. All right. Well, so the one... movie that a lot of people would argue should have won over Dances for Best Picture, maybe for some other things too. It was up for a fair number of nominations as well. Best Picture, Best Actor, Best Actress, Best Director, Writing and Editing. It's Goodfellas. So, first of all, I mean, it's a great cast. De Niro, Leota, and Pesci.
Yeah.
If you make a gangster movie, you'd be hard-pressed to get three better leads than those three.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you could argue maybe Pacino for one of them or something, but still, those three guys, pretty great. As a whole, how did you feel that this movie did in terms of the structure, in terms of the way that because it's a very different film. You know, there's a lot less silences. There's fewer of these panoramic kinds of shots with the wide lens to see the horizon. You know, it's a city. It's very urban. There's a lot more profanity.
I think it does probably one of the best jobs I've seen of telling or painting the picture of what a crime family is like. You could say that Godfather does a good job of that, but that's isolated to honestly a few characters versus this movie has a lot more crime syndicate and kind of family members and other associates woven throughout it. a lot of different activities versus kind of inter-crime family struggle. It's more of just about sort of the struggle of different people within a single crime family and the acts they're committing. So I like that it really painted that tiered system of like what associates are doing, what made men are doing, right? And kind of all of that. I don't have much exposure to Liotta. This is probably like his best movie he's ever done. He's not really in very many other significant films of high bill.
No, he's not. So I know him from a few things. He's in Copland, mm-hmm. which is an amazing Sylvester Stallone movie. In fact, it's also got Harvey Keitel. It's an underrated film. He was in, the first time he came to my notice, I was in college, and I saw a film called No Escape.
Mm-hmm.
I think it might have been direct-to-video or an HBO film. It was not, I don't think, a theater release.
Hmm.
It is, in all honesty, a bad film. But it was exactly what 19-year-old me wanted for a weekend when I was in college, because it was ridiculous.
Yeah.
Just ridiculous. And I really like Liotta as an actor, as a consequence. And so he doesn't get a lot of lead parts, but he does really well playing these kinds of various forms of gangster, I think.
Yeah. It's nice that it's like it's a single narrative, because it's about like his kind of introduction into the crime world as someone who is half Irish, half Italian. He proactively joins it, right? When he's a kid, he's very interested in it. And it's about obviously his rise through the family and ultimately kind of the fall of the family and himself. But there's a lot of random little stories woven throughout, which is cool. A lot of different scenes and tales that go on. So it's singular, but also a lot of different facets at the same time.
Was it just me, or were you also, did you also have difficulty keeping all the characters straight beyond kind of the big four? Five characters.
Yeah. I mean, the names are thrown out there so fast. And it's not like they pan to someone all the time with names. They did it actually in one scene as they go through the restaurant or the nightclub. But a lot of those people actually played zero role in the film. Only like, what, six or seven of those actually really made appearances to any meaningful extent. But yeah, it was tough. You definitely know who, like, obviously, the cover shot of film. You know who De Niro is, you know Joe Pesci, you know Liotta, you know Pauly. You probably know the guy with the fro, and the guy who owns the wig shop, and you know maybe one or two other people. The wife, obviously the female character is the wife and those other characters, but yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I really had trouble. It felt like there were a zillion names, and I couldn't keep track of who they were.
It's a very fast-paced film, even though it's 2.5 hours long.
Well, it's frenetic, right? Like, there's a lot of jumping around, which is weird because there's also a lot of long shots.
True.
Where he'll do a long shot where the, you know, big one take, like the introductions you were talking about in the nightclub, mm-hmm. where it goes through and he's narrating over it as it visits all these different people and we see them say things or whatever. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of that too. And it's weird that it has that long shot artistic kind of feel to parts of it. But at the same time, there's also a lot more choppiness in terms of the narrative. Mm-hmm. It jumps around quite a bit from place to place to place.
It does.
Yeah. I'm probably not a great person for talking about this because I really don't like this movie.
What are your issues with it?
I find it hard to even really know somewhat. I can say some things, and you're probably going to feel these are inadequate. But probably the biggest one, first and foremost, is there are no pleasant characters. There's no one in this movie that's at all nice.
I have comments on that, but proceed. Well,
no, go ahead. I mean, hit me with it.
Well, that's the intent, right? It's Goodfellas is a complete misnomer for who these people are.
Right.
They're all bad, and even the people who don't start out as bad are corruptible. there's no one good in this film. So I agree with your assessment that there is no one good in the film. That's not a problem for me. I kind of think that's a point, but
I hate that. I hate that about a movie. And I, yeah, if there's no one in the film, I've said this before in other contexts and maybe not exactly. If there's no one in the film that I can root for. No one I can identify with. No one I can. I don't like the idea of like, oh, I need to identify with this person. Like, they need to be like me. Not so much even like me, but like there's somebody whose point of view I can understand and not appreciate, that I can approve of in some sense. I don't really like it. I'm not enjoying watching all these really unpleasant people make these really bad decisions.
I should have known that would be one of your critiques, actually, because that's a thing for you. I feel more so. Sometimes I can fall into this place of enjoying downer films where there is no redeemable person. Get mob films tend to be easy ones for that.
Yeah, what's weird about this is that they don't even necessarily have to be good guys for me to be able to appreciate them in the way that I'm talking about. There's a Mel Gibson film called Payback. If you've ever seen this, heard of this. They're based on a series of novels. Well, it's based on one novel out of a series of novels. The main character is called Parker. They change it in this movie. He's called Porter, but he's a villain. He's primarily a thief, though that doesn't really make it, you know, that sounds a little more tame. He's an armed robber. He's a heister. He's a, you know, he murders people if he has to, but it's not what his primary, he's not a hitman. And these stories, I really enjoy them. It's, I think, because his attitude at least makes sense to me. He is Nietzschean in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
Right, that he has decided to be the Superman. His will to power is such, and for me, philosophically, I think that at least makes sense. Whereas Henry Hill is a weak man who's driven by appetites and is blown about by, you know, things that should not influence him. You know, he gets sucked into the drugs. Like, Pauly in this movie is probably my favorite of the characters.
Oh, he's the most redeemable in a weird way.
Because he has the strongest code. But even at the end, I feel irritated with him for, you know, reacting the way he does. And he's really not one of the main characters.
Oh, no.
He's not in the movie a ton. You know, he figures behind the scenes and he's kind of a shadow there. But
I think he's perfectly cast, though.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, what's his name?
If we have to talk about, Paul Sorvino,
I think.
How he performs in that role. Yeah, he does fabulously. So for what limited space he occupies, I would agree. I think he does an awesome job.
I think if there was more about him and why he thinks and does the things he does, I might be able to appreciate this movie more. But I'm just not sure if he really believes he is doing what is the right thing. Like, I think Henry Hill and Joe Pesci's character, whatever his name is, Tommy, and James Conway's De Niro, I think all three of them know they're being evil.
Yeah.
And that they've come to terms with that in some way, but they don't really have the same code.
It would have been nice if they spent more time trying to make it clear, like, how a mob family operates in terms of its money making activities. Because is it Pauly or just Paul? They call him Pauly, right?
They call him Pauly, but yeah.
Yeah. Pauly is obviously like old school kind of racketeering, construction, like fraud, theft type income, which is kind of original mafia activities. But there's this turning point in the film, which obviously they talk about because they say, let's not let like Pauly find out about the drugs. But there's a turning point in the film where those three main characters become new school with their criminal activities to a point where it gets more violent, more dangerous, stuff that Pauly would never want the family to be involved in. But they don't really talk about like that clear distinction that much. That may have helped if they had done that.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it also then starts to cross over into what I call the Joker problem, mm-hmm. which is not some brilliant insight on my part, but this is the way I think about it. In one of those Batman movies that Nolan did, which one was it? The Dark Knight?
You're talking about the second one with the Joker?
Yeah.
Dark Knight, yeah. We've talked about this before.
Yeah, we have talked about this in person, but it's not been on the podcast. The evil that he portrays is far too appealing.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't say that it's that way for me, necessarily, but the way that I see and read people talk about this film and the things that they cite as being the parts they enjoy or the parts that they laugh at or the parts that they find, you know, the best for whatever value that, you know, criteria are the things that I find most reprehensible.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, wasn't it so funny when the guy wakes up in the trunk of the car and they pull over on the side of the road and stab him six more times? Like, no.
No.
These people are psychopaths. Like, what is wrong with you that you think this movie's a fantastic movie? Like, there's nothing. This isn't a good movie in a moral way.
They try to have moments which really don't come across as giving Liotta, like, any more fiber. But obviously his reaction to some of the stuff that Tommy does indicates that he doesn't want to be a violent person when he doesn't have to be. I'm thinking of when Tommy shoots the kid in the foot. So Liotta's reaction to that, you know, obviously they're drawing a distinction between who he is and who Tommy is. But, you know, at the end of the day, these are people who are murdering, you know, very violent people. There's not much of a distinction really between Tommy and Liotta at the end of the day.
No. There is in the film, mm-hmm. as you say, that effort. But and this only occurred to me right this second, I wonder if this is, because it's portrayed as a true story and it's told from his point of view, if this is an instance of an unreliable narrator.
Maybe.
Right? Where he is trying to make himself seem less bad than the people around him, when really he was just as much of a psychotic, murdering, you know, villain yeah. as they were.
Yeah.
But he's the one who's, you know, history's written by the victors. You know, he's the one who's getting to tell the story. So it wasn't as bad as these guys. Like, oh, sure, I robbed some people, and I may have shot a guy once, but I wasn't like these guys just killing people at random for no reason.
Yeah, they did. I mean, I think they did use a lot of material from that guy, Henry Hill, the real person who was part of this gang for the movie. So it could be.
It's a very unpleasant movie to watch. I did not like it.
Random sidebar. Thing, but like, remember the scene where Tommy and I don't remember the fro guy's name, where they kill, is it Samuel L. Jackson?
Yeah.
Samuel L. Jackson, they whack him. Apparently I didn't find an article right now on this. I think I've seen an article on before, but some of that scene was unscripted where fro guy is holding the coffee. That's an accident. I think as they walk out the door, it's an accident that he's still holding it. He's not supposed to be in the script. And so Tommy's reaction, like, can we get that coffee to go? Like, just kidding. That's all, I think, just on the spot, which makes the scene hilariously awful, right? Because
they played it well. I mean, they played it off and integrated it fine.
Mm-hmm.
It's not quite, you know, leave the gun, take the cannoli, but it's,
no. Yeah.
It's still a good moment. Yeah.
Yeah. Has a Pulp Fiction kind of vibe to it.
Yeah.
No, that's true. Also because Samuel L. Jackson, but.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I found it interesting that Henny Youngman in the movie, the stand up, was actually Henny Youngman.
The stand up? What do you mean?
So there's one scene in the Copa where they're at the club and they have a stand up comic doing the one liners.
Oh, okay. And they're like,
here's Henny Youngman, king of the one liners, or whatever. It's actually him.
Really?
He's just like 30 years older than he would have been in that real scene.
I didn't notice that at all. That's cool.
Yeah. So that's why he's an old man, is because they got the actual Henny Youngman to stand up there and tell jokes.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah.
So with this movie, I mean, the reason we picked these movies, right, or at least on the surface would have picked these movies for this pod, is that people nowadays would probably think Goodfellas would win. Is that the general average consensus, right?
I think so. I think so.
But how does that fall for you?
Oh, if it was down to these two, there's no question I'd pick Dances over Goodfellas. I actively dislike Goodfellas.
I like watching Dances more for whatever mystical reason. And I think I said this last podcast, I do enjoy that film. I appreciated Goodfellas more watching it again this time around, but I would probably agree with you and say I prefer Dances.
Interesting. Interesting. Well, I mean, if you go on, you know, IMDb or whatever, and you sort the movies by year for popularity, Goodfellas is above it.
If substantially in rating.
Yeah. It's interesting to look at some of the other movies that came out this year. This is the year Pretty Woman came out.
So one thing I wanted to bring up on that note is that for Robert De Niro, he acted in two big movies during this year. He was also in Awakenings with Robin Williams. Do you know this movie?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've seen that.
Mm-hmm. So I was just impressed that he played, you know, what is it? James Burke is his character. James Conway. James Burke is the real name of the person in real life. But James Conway. And then he also played the disabled actor in Awakening so well. I thought that was pretty impressive for his range for that year.
Yeah. I mean, De Niro's a good actor. It's interesting that he had time to do them both.
I know. That was weird.
One of them got delayed in terms of when it was shot to when it was released, which can happen.
Yeah.
So, Godfather Part 3, the Arnold Schwarzenegger classic Total Recall came out this year. This is the year of Home Alone, Back to the Future Part 3, Misery. What else we got? Ghost, which is another movie I have not seen, but classic. Romantic movie. What else have we got? Die Hard 2.
There's a lot of good films this year, or at least films that are commonly considered pretty high quality nowadays.
Yeah, a lot of notable ones at any rate. I mean, again, I wouldn't say necessarily that Ghost or Pretty Woman were movies that would compete for Best Picture that should have been in this conversation. Mm-hmm. There's certainly movies that have legs that people are going to continue to watch and have a continuing appeal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's commonly accepted that Godfather 3 is not in the same caliber as 1 and 2, right?
Yes. And I would agree with that. It's not as well made. And it suffers from Robert Duvall wouldn't come back for that movie because... what I read was that his part was too small. He was like, forget this. Leonard Nimoy refusing to be in the transition movie, Star Trek Generations.
Right.
You know, they wanted him, but he wouldn't do it. Yeah. So there were two movies that I watched besides these two. I watched, Hunt for Red October, and I've seen that a bunch of times. A handful of times anyways. So I watched it with a commentary on this time.
Okay.
Which was fun. John McTiernan directed it. Same guy directed Die Hard. It is a really good movie.
I wanted to watch it. I told you that for this session, but I didn't have time. So tell me about your thoughts on it.
Have you seen Hunt for Red October?
I have seen it once before. I think it was not a clean all the way through watch. I think I had to like start and stop a couple of times, and this was like 10 years ago. So,
yeah. So Hunt for October, based on the novel by Tom Clancy, was his first big novel. He later suffered from the J.K. Rowling phenomenon where his success prevented his editors from being able to really put their foot down on him. Mm-hmm. So it's also his shortest book, I believe, even though it is still quite long. It is a really good novel. It's just a really fun tale of the sea about a submarine that is going rogue for some form or fashion. There's some debate on the two sides, trying to figure out the Americans, trying to figure out if the Russians are telling the truth that he's going to launch his missiles, or if, as also might be the case, he's trying to defect. And they try and find him as he's using this new silent propulsion system to slip through the North Atlantic. He's getting chased relentlessly. Again, the cast in this is just astonishing in some ways. Alec Baldwin in his first major role, I think.
Yeah.
Sean Connery, Scott Glenn, who we had in Apocalypse Now recently as well. He plays one of the sub-captains. Sam Neill as the Russian executive officer, but also Stellan Skarsgård as another Russian sub-captain. The villain, the real kind of hidden spy villain on the Russian boat, is also another person that you would recognize if you saw him, because he's been in a million things. I can't think of his name now. James Earl Jones is in this movie. Fred Thompson, later to be a Law and Order fame and a senator from Kentucky, Tennessee, somewhere, is in this. I mean, it's just chock full of really good actors. It's really well plotted and scripted. They managed to keep a lot of the book. It's a great military story. And even, yeah.
I need to watch it. I need to watch it again, essentially. Because, yeah, I wanted to watch it in time for this to compare it, but didn't have a chance. So,
yeah, really good movie. I would put that above either of the other two films.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, I would. I like it better than both of them. In terms of the quality as a film, I think it's better, but I think it's stuck as a genre picture to a degree that usually hamstrings films from being successful. In a way that Dances with Wolves probably ought to have been, in the sense of this is the way things normally function. As a Western, Westerns don't get, I think Cimarron was the Western before it to win Best Picture, and that was in, what, 1931 or something silly?
Yeah.
So
it's more of a traps him. It's more of an action thriller film too, which those, I feel like it's harder for them to appease a lot of the auteurs at the Academy Awards as being something about broad, important concepts or something artistic, you know?
Yeah, that's true. It has that sense, but I think that is in large part a real testament to McTiernan as a director and whoever, you know, he got to help him with the script, wrote the script, because it really doesn't lend itself to that.
Yeah. I mean,
submarines don't have windows, right? They don't actively.
Fun fact for basically, you. Well,
I know that seems obvious, but it's all these. It's a whole bunch of men in a tightly confined room, trying to be as quiet as possible, and basically, in a sense, tiptoeing around, listening for other, you know, their enemy. That's what this movie is.
Yeah.
And at this, yet despite that, it feels exciting. It feels like an adventurous kind of story. When it's really a bunch of, you know, engineers trying to use technology to listen for someone else.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. I'm not a claustrophobic person, but every time I see the inside of a real submarine, like in photos or something, I feel claustrophobic.
Oh, with good reason. It's good reason. Yeah.
That to me is far past the limit of what I would be, I think, willing to tolerate.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we're running long. If you don't care, I don't care. But the other movie that I watched was Miller's Crossing, which is a Coen Brothers film. It is also out same year. It's a magnificent movie, in my opinion. It is one of my favorites that they have done. It is not one of their more popular films of all the ones they have done. So you're going to have to take what my opinion with a grain of salt here, knowing what I like. It's a noir. It borrows very heavily from the Dashiell Hammett story, The Glass Key, which was made into a film a couple times, most notably with Alan Ladd and Veronica Lake back in the 30s, which is phenomenal. This movie, I think, is even better in the same way that I think that their version of True Grit was better than the John Wayne version.
Okay.
That they managed to do a lot of the same things that the original did. They hit a lot of the right beats, but then they were able to end it in a more satisfactory way because they're not slavishly held to the kind of Hollywood happy ending formula. Miller's Crossing, for anybody that doesn't know, is a story about a town run by gangsters in which one of them, the head of one of the mobs, really the only mob, is challenged by someone who is kind of an upstart, someone who's, you know, wanting something and is not getting it. He feels like he's being treated unfairly. And there is a woman at the center of this who is persuading the mob boss to act in a certain way. And his right-hand man and best friend is arguing that she doesn't really care for him, that she's manipulating him to her own ends, and that he is making a foolish mistake as regards to his business. And this ends up driving a wedge between them, and it becomes a movie about what is that friend going to do? Is he going to turn on him? Is he going to try and serve his own interests? Mm-hmm. Is he going to, you know, and it's just really well done. Gabriel Byrne, Albert Finney, John Turturro, Steve Buscemi is in this. Such a good movie. Such a good movie.
Solid year. 1991 yeah. Awards.
Really was. Really was. Well, I've probably filibustered this podcast long enough here. Final thoughts, concluding opinions, things that you just didn't get a chance to say?
I think of the three podcasts we've recorded thus far, these two, and I think we both agree here, probably the closest to where we're somewhat indifferent about which two we would pick, the ones we really focused on, other than the ones you just mentioned, which is okay because there's just a lot of like at a good quality level films for that year. Seems like mm-hmm. it was clear. But yeah, not as stark of a contrast. So probably something that if we had other opinions on this show or other people commenting, it could be people are split. I don't know. Could be a vast diversity of opinion on this topic.
Yeah, there could be. There could be certainly. I mean, I would pick Dances. I would say that it's fine of the two, but I'm not fired up about it. And if I was to pick the movie I liked, it wouldn't have been either one of these two. So
yeah,
agreed. Well, I think it's, I mean, again, we've gone on for a little while longer than we have even before this. But next time, I think we're slated to do Chariots of Fire and Raiders of the Lost Ark. So I don't remember what year that is. 1981.
This is going back 9 years in time. Kind of been hopping around, which is always fun.
Yeah. So Chariots of Fire 1. Raiders was, of course, notable. Harrison Ford started a little bit of a mini franchise. Yeah, we'll see if we think Chariots deserves it. Have you seen either of these films? I imagine you've seen Raiders.
I've seen both of them, but similar to Hunt for Red October, Chariots of Fire I saw a long time ago, like with my dad or something, because he really loves that film. So we'll have to see. It's completely different films in terms of their pace and energy. So it'll be a good contrast.
Oh, yeah. 100%. Yeah. 100%. Well, I really thoroughly enjoyed this conversation. If it was just left up to me and I had no other constraints, I could just keep going. But I appreciate you taking time to have this conversation. I appreciate any listeners who are actually listening for an hour and 15 minutes that got to the end. Thank you for doing so. And I guess we'll sign off here and we'll talk to you again in a couple of weeks.
Sounds good. Thanks, everyone, for listening. And for the people who are, feel free to leave comments or requests on other films you'd like to see.
Yeah, we should probably develop an easy way for people to do that.
Let's enable that. Yeah.
All right. Cool. All right. Hasta la vista.
Thanks, folks.